ESPN 107.3 presents Wild at Heart, bringing outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm agent Michelle Beckett. Now, here's Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM and the Pulse of the Ozarks, beautiful Rolla, Missouri. I'm your host, Tommy Bench. Jerry Cook is out this week, but John Francis, our engineer, is here in the studio with me. Welcome to Wild at Heart. We are red-blooded Americans who remember and cherish our outdoor heritage. We love America and support the Second Amendment. We stand for our national anthem, say please and thank you, and open doors for the ladies. We hunt, fish, trap, shoot, float, camp, and explore in God's country, the Missouri Ozarks, right out your back door and occasionally a few points beyond. Join us each week Wednesday at 4 p.m. right here on ESPN 107.3 FM, or catch us Sundays at 8 a.m. or anytime online at ESPN1073.com. This segment of Wild at Heart is brought to you by J. Cook Fly Rods Custom Fly Rods, plus everything you need for fly fishing, located in downtown Salem, and Harvey Alley's Spring Canoe Rental, located on the crystal clear Jack's Fork River. Terry Robertson is a retired conservation agent, and we have him on the line now. Terry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Tommy. Good to be here.
Yeah, good to hear from you. I was wanting to see what you thought about this deer season so far this year. Have you heard any good stories?
I had several good stories, but I think the cool snap, we saw a little more action. But the heat's been the dominant part of this whole story. A lot of people really not wanting to participate when it's like that, and I don't blame them at all. It's kind of miserable out there this year with the chiggers and ticks that we've got.
I've heard that's been really bad.
They're playing havoc on a lot of the hunters, especially since the fall turkey season just kicked off. But we've had a few harvested around the county and around the area, but it's hard to do when it's 80 degrees and 70 at night, and you've got to get those deer cleaned and put away pretty quick.
Right.
They quickly spoil in this kind of weather.
That's exactly right. That's the main thing is you do harvest a deer, you've got to retrieve it very quickly, otherwise it's going to go bad overnight.
And it sure will. So, we've had this for many years with the warming trend that we've had off and on. We've even seen 80-degree days on the opening day of deer season, firearms deer season, in mid-November. So it's, and of course, we've always also seen snowfall and freezing in the same time, so it's just depending on what kind of moves across the country and the cause of the fronts.
Yeah, you never know. Is there any particular weather that you think is ideal for the deer themselves as far as their movement? From what you've seen, because, you know, you're a retired conservation agent, and, you know, you've seen a lot over the years. And so what do you think on what just your experience and on the history of Missouri deer hunting in Pulaski County in particular?
Most of what my opinion comes from is observation. I read a lot of materials from my biologists up in Jeff City and from different generals around the country. I'm not one that's a whitetail expert, but I noticed as our population grew from the time that I got here in the late 70s through the time that I left here in 97, the higher the population got, with the higher number of does in the population, it seemed like we got a longer and longer stretch of rut throughout the year, all the way into January. Sometimes you would still see, in February, still see bucks sporting their antlers, and even finding some scrapes in January.
Wow.
Which was unheard of when I first started.
Well, here's a question for you that I've always wondered. You know, I hear people talk a lot about the second rut. Is the second rut, is that a proven time frame, or is that just the way the deer you know, just like anything else, just because this fish spawns at this certain time doesn't mean they don't spawn a little bit later, or the one don't. Is that something that they're just kind of spread out as they the rut moves on, or is there actually two different ruts?
I don't want to say that they're two different ruts, but I know that we've got an extended rut. When I first got here, we I don't know if you were – you weren't around probably then. We I don't know what year you were born, Tommy. But
79.
In the early days that I got here, we had two managed hunts on Fort Leonard. One was in October, and the other one was over Exodus over the Christmas break for Fort Leonard Wood in late December. And by the time it was an any deer hunt in late December, and an antlerless only hunt in October, or they may have had some special buck permits in that hunt too, but. The one in late December was antlerless only because the deer had lost most of their antlers. We would find people that would begin to drag a deer out with an antler on it, and they'd come off in their hands.
Oh, wow.
And you didn't see many antlers after that, which is an indication that the hormones have just gone. In the later on years, I remember this distinctly. I was on an end-of-the-season squirrel hunt, which was December 31st in those days. Out in Shockley Bottom, north of Waynesville, and I came down a ridgeline, and I'd gone down many, many times. We had about a half inch of snow the night before, and I started to see fresh scrapes. Some of them still steaming at the end of the ridge in late December, which was I'd never seen before.
Yeah, that's
and
odd.
Just my opinion. It was the number of does that we had in the hunt. You know, as the number of does increased in population, the number of bucks could further impregnate throughout the year if they had an extended rut. And I think that it's more of an extended rut now than it is a second rut. But they do have a peak in that second rut, I believe.
And what dictates the peak, do you think? I mean, is there something that dictates that? Or
I just think it's the level of hormones that they get. It's going to have a lot to do with sunlight for one, and weather for one, and availability of food for one, I'd say. You know, availability of real nutritious forage for them to have.
Right. And that makes sense.
I'm also, over the years, in the periods of drought, have seen a rut that just is short-lived because of nutrition they got through the summer. That was non-existent because their grain browse and stuff had basically burned up.
That's interesting. You know, that's something else I was thinking about. Those deer during the rut literally will almost kill themselves just trying to chase does around. Do you see
Absolutely.
That? And they probably do. I'm sure there's cases where they do kill themselves from malnutrition and just vigorously running and chasing. You see them. I've seen them myself going through with just foam coming out of their mouth. They can barely even breathe, but they just keep on trucking.
Well, I don't know if that's an indication of being fatigued or more plumb out. I think it's more of a condition of desire.
Yeah.
If you want to know.
Right.
I've seen it when I looked a little bit down the Crowley's Ridge down toward the Blue Hill one afternoon. It was opening day or the second day. I was riding with an agent down there. We came along the edge of a field, just like a 40-acre field, and it was right next to the road, heavy traffic, blacktop. Four does came chasing across in the backside, and a buck, just a giant buck, I mean like a 12-pointer, followed along behind them. And we're sitting there in the car, hollering and screaming at the deer, and he didn't pay any more attention to us than he did the man in the moon. And basically, that's been one of the reasons given by the biologists that we harvest so many big bucks,
is that
we hunt them with a rifle during the rut. And if you look around, a lot of the states that are joining us, like Kansas or Iowa, I'm not so sure about Illinois, they've had a zoning system, but a lot of them hunt after the rut with firearms.
Oh.
So when the peak of the rut ends, that decreases the chance of killing a giant buck because they stop moving like they did. They get their senses back, so to speak.
Yeah, they're not making as bad more. They're not making as many mistakes because of that.
No,
right. That makes perfect sense, and that's another thing, you know, that I was wanting to talk about. There's a lot of big bucks around our area that is, you know, people don't think that there is. I've seen some, and I'm sure you have too. Some giant bucks. I know one back in the 80s from Crocker, which is Pulaski County, and you probably remember it. And it was almost 200 inches. You know, so that's amazing.
I measured several over the years for big bucks, and then set them on. I measured Boone and Crockett, Pope and Young, but we didn't get it official until you sent somebody that went to the academy that would put you in the official books. But I measured several. One in Crockett, one of the first ones I measured was a 170, and I didn't think I'd ever see a deer that big, and saw it right away my first 2 months here.
Wow.
And it'd been taken a couple of years before that. It was mounted on the wall. But that was several big deer. So long story short, we seized a buck that was taken illegally on Fort Wood years and years ago that was almost 202 inches.
Wow.
It was illegal because it was shot out of the cantonment area, out of the car wash on Fort Wood.
Yeah.
You know, big car, the old car wash back in the, this was in the 90s, early 90s. But it was a huge buck.
Well, I'd like to talk more about them big bucks. We got to take a break here, Terry, but we'll be right back with retired conservation agent Terry Robertson. I'm Tommy Bench. This is Wild at Heart, and we'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment is brought to you by Cowtown USA, home of Can-Am ATVs and UTVs, and Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. It's not just land, it's a lifestyle, and we live it. Retired Pulaski County Conservation Agent Terry Robertson is on the phone with us, and we're talking about fall seasonal hunting. So, Terry, let's talk about that a little bit.
Oh, this was absolutely, I was an avid turkey hunter. I love the spring and the beauty of the spring in the Ozarks with red buds and dogwoods and persimmons, everything blooming in the spring. But I really love fall season. October was one of my favorite months. Even if you'd have had a drought summer and had some wet rain into the fall, you know, you take off to go after. One of my favorite hunts was just to take off with my little 20-gauge pump and actively seek a turkey and harvest a turkey if I could. And if I did harvest one, I hunted squirrels back to the truck. And the added bounty was a lot of times coral or reindeer or elk horn mushrooms and puffballs and a bunch of persimmons. It was a great, great time in the Ozarks. Every year I look forward to October. You just don't see a lot of folks hunting small game like you used to.
No, you don't. And that's interesting you talk about that, because October is my absolute favorite month of the year as well. I love it. I think it's just a great time of the year for everything, especially if you love the outdoors. There's usually good fishing, deer season, turkey hunting, and just the things you just mentioned. And it's just a great time. Usually you got good weather. And, you know, getting back to the small game, what are some of the your favorite small games this time of year? You mentioned.
Well, I grew up hunting squirrel, and this time of year, with them cutting hickory, walnut, a lot of different forage base, but just generally the nut trees, and creeping through the woods in the morning, listening to the ratchet of their jaws on a hard nut casing, and finding them and taking them out, and it was just great. And just to give you an example of how it's changed is years ago we went from 6 squirrels daily to 10 daily. And we don't have, I don't hear a lot of stories anymore about squirrel hunters. I hear a lot about mushroom hunting, of course. And we've had this year a bounty of coral mushrooms. And I also liked, when we had them, game birds, quail, north and out of state for pheasant.
Yeah.
And and I love fall turkey hunting too. It was just as exciting to me to fall hunt as it was in the spring.
So the tactics for fall turkey hunting is a little bit different, though, isn't it?
Yep.
Because you know, in the spring, of course, they're gobbling away, and you know, the fall you got the pelts. You know, it's a little bit different. I mean, explain how that's different. How you would approach the fall hunting versus the spring hunting.
Oh, you just you spend a little time scouting. I used to not scout at all after I'd hunted turkey for a long time in the spring. I would come out and just move in until I could hear a bird, move to the bird if I could. Or if I was close, just sit down and try to hunt. But in the fall, sometimes you really got to do a lot of walking, and sometimes it might be 2 or 3 miles that you walk. But it's sometimes you walk 25 feet and you're on them. You call and a bunch walks up to you. And a lot of times it's just blind calling. You do the lost hen call or kiki runs.
Yeah.
One of the tactics people always use was breaking up the flock and then calling them back.
Yes.
That worked. I've done it before. I've called in big flocks of brotherhood, the adult gobblers, before in the fall, and was lucky enough to kill a few big gobblers in the fall. But just the overall experience, because it's very hot this time right now this year. But, man, toward the middle of the month, it was used to be great. Be frosty in the morning. You get out there and work for a little while hunting and take off and wander through the woods. If you're lucky enough to take a turkey, try hunting some squirrels up and then working on mushrooms or whatever you want to do. And, of course, one of my hobbies all those years, as much as I walked and got into the ravines, you know, the drainages in the bottom between the ridges.
Right.
I started collecting box turtle shells, box turtles that had died.
Right.
In the winter, and their shells washed down the creeks. You'll find them always in the creek bottoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those dry creek beds. And I've got, I don't know how many of those I've given to folks that they've made turkey calls out of.
Wow.
And it was, the fall of the season was always the best memories, and it's always the most beautiful. You get that, as the sun starts to move toward its southern path, you get that, what I call that low daylight look during the day. You've got a more of a golden, it's my opinion, more of a golden look in the woods. And if you got all that fall color, it's like being in a Catholic cathedral at times with that sun coming through there.
Right. No, I agree. I love the fall as well. Like I said, I think that everything is just so much better. In the fall, the weather's better. I think there's just so much more to offer in the fall. Other than the ticks, I know you was talking about how bad the ticks are this year. I've heard that from a lot of people, and I'm sure that's solely based because of the heat. You know, we haven't had any good frost. So,
yeah, that's true. I don't know. It's just been a long, hot, dry summer, and it's been kind of telling on everybody. And hopefully, that it cools off soon and gives a relief to the boys that are out there and the girls that are out there deer standing right now. That's got to be miserable with skeeters.
Oh, it's got to be.
Jiggers.
Well, I haven't even been. You know, I'm usually one of those that get out there opening day and it's just gung ho. I've got to go every weekend. You know, I'm bow hunting nonstop. I love archery season and can't wait because it's been so long since I've been out there. You're excited because all the game camera pictures you have, even though I don't even have a game camera out there, but you see it from other people. Hey, check out the buck I have on camera. And what do you got? I don't have anything. I know what runs around my woods for the most part. And I just like the surprise of not knowing. But I haven't been out there. I guess the point of it is I have not been out there mainly because of the heat. I don't want to get out there and be miserable. I want to enjoy myself. And I figured I'd wait until it got a little bit cooler. So that's kind of what I'm looking forward to as well.
And, of course, in the fall, what I used to do, when my father-in-law was still alive down here, and spend the morning and get just like I said, I used to call it the Ozark Grand Slam, a turkey, a limit of squirrels, a pile of mushrooms, a bucket full of persimmons.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go to, if I was back by noon, clean my game up, we'd go on the river.
Even better.
We'd fish for some basically, we never kept any guide line. My father-in-law did a few of them that were big enough. You know, his size limit was 10 inches. So,
oh yeah,
we didn't see too many of them back in those days.
No, you still don't see a ton of them that size.
Our stringers are usually full of bluegill, what we call black perch or green sunfish.
Mm-hmm.
Some crappies, Piney produces some crappie every now and then, pretty good ones too. Have this year, even. Not in great abundance, but you'll see somebody goes out there like Dave Harbaugh that's got his place down here on the river. Went out last week, or maybe it was the week before, took, I can't remember the pictures on Facebook, 5 or 6 pretty decent crappie.
Wow.
As he went up the river here, and it's, a lot of it's because some of these gravel pit ponds,
mm-hmm.
A lot of smaller ones are stocked full of stunted crappie, but then they get flooded and they get out in the river and they grow some more.
Oh, that makes sense. I wondered how them crappie got in the river like that, because see, it's the same way on the Gasconade. We catch them, but they're not everywhere. And then when you do catch them, they're usually really good size. You don't catch little ones very often, but like you said, they've got a great food source now to where they can get bigger. What is it about the crappie that I've noticed? They've got a black stripe. The ones I catch in the river anyway, they have a black stripe going right down the middle of their back.
Well, I'd have to look at what you're seeing. A lot of coloration on fish comes from the color of the water.
Oh,
the
really?
The quality of the water, mainly.
Okay.
But there's two species of crappie in the state, black crappie and white crappie.
Right. I know, but these are like black crappie, but they have a distinct black stripe, I mean, right down the middle of their back. If you touch their nose and went right over to the very edge of them, it's just a black stripe about a quarter inch wide. And it's not just me that's noticed it. I've had all my buddies saying, yeah, them river crappie will have a black stripe on them. Say, yeah, that's what I catch too. It's kind of weird. I didn't know if there's anything to it.
Well, if you think about it, it's probably got to do with river clarity and camouflage from predators from above, usually birds.
True. Okay.
Or any predator fish that'd be swimming in deep water above or in shallow water above them, preying on the crappie that are in the beds.
Yeah.
The beds. And crappie do bed pretty deep.
Well, that makes sense.
But you also look at the crappie coloration at Lake of the Ozarks. Do you ever see that? You never see that out of Lake of the Ozarks, do you?
No, I've never seen that out of Lake of the Ozarks.
But that's my opinion. I mean, I don't know that that's a scientific fact.
I'll have to send you a picture of one, show you what I'm talking about, see what you think. But that's kind of like smallmouth. I've heard a lot of people in the past ask me, you know, and I would know a lot more about this than I do. But you know, what makes a smallmouth, for example, one have really dark colorations and vibrant, you know, stripes or bars, rather than one that may be really pale? Is, you know, are they coming from deeper water? Are they generally darker? You know, the camouflage. I know they change. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I believe that water clarity has a lot to do with it, and maybe genetics too.
True. Yeah, just like us.
You know, there's probably, I don't know, a lot of subspecies out there that are just in indigenous to the one stream or one watershed.
Yeah.
That's just a theory.
No, I agree.
But I've always thought that the lighter the fish, you look at the largemouth out of Lake of the Ozarks, and Lake of the Ozarks in the summertime is, you can see very few feet below the surface.
True.
You know, water doesn't penetrate very far.
That's right. Well, Terry,
what I see is a lot of washed out largemouth look like.
Exactly. Terry, we're out of time here. I've got to get us on to the next segment. We got to take a break here. So, hey, thank you so much for being on the show, and I can't wait to have you back on again. You're so full of information. So thanks again.
Thanks,
Terry. We'll talk to you.
Bye.
All right, bye. Coming up in segment 3, we'll be talking about a big camping trip I took a couple weeks ago with my lifelong high school buddies. You're listening to Wild at Heart. I'm Tommy Bench. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. Remember, you can always listen to Wild at Heart anytime you want at our website, ESPN1073.com. Just click Programming and Wild at Heart, or you can tell Alexa on your Amazon Echo to play the Wild at Heart podcast from TuneIn Radio.
So, Tommy, I hear rumors that you just got back from a big camping trip. So, tell me about this. Where'd you go? What'd you do?
To the Gasconade, and what happened is we was planning this big trip with me and my longtime buddies that I went to school with. Wade Early, Rex Larson, James Hendricks, and then there's a couple others.
And these are guys you've been to school with since, like, kindergarten, right?
I have literally known these individuals since I was 5 years old.
Yeah,
and
wow.
So we're lifelong friends, and life took us in different directions, but we all come back to our roots where we grew up. And it was good because that's kind of my profession now as a river guide. It was right up my alley, and they enjoyed doing it, and I enjoyed taking them, and it was a trip of a lifetime as far as I'm concerned. And it was so fun that we literally – set it up to be an annual event, you know. So next year we're going to have the second annual. We call it the Boats and Bros.
Okay.
So it's the first annual Boats and Bros camping trip.
All right.
It was amazing. It was an absolute. It was fun. I just can't even explain how much excitement we had, and it was neat, you know, because like I said, we took off. We've been planning this for a long time.
So your two buddies. Well, first off, what do they do now?
Wade Early, he's a like I said, we went to school our entire lives. He is a attorney.
Okay.
He's got his own law firm, I believe, in Springfield, Missouri.
Okay.
And then Rex Larson is he's been in the law enforcement his entire life. He is actually the SRO for the school that my children attend.
Oh, okay.
So he's the school resource officer,
right,
is what he is. He's in charge of that. He's got another guy that works there. He's in law enforcement. Good man. And they both are. And then James Hendricks, he is he works on post on Fort Leonard Wood, some kind of water. He does water.
He's a civilian on post?
He's a civilian on post. Okay. That's right. And then so those are the only four that was able to make it to this trip.
Okay.
I didn't want to make it super huge because I didn't know how this was going to go.
Right.
So I thought I'd start small with these guys, and then over the years maybe it'll expand. But it was great. It went way better than I planned. I remember this, you'll get a kick out of this, John. Wade asked me, he goes, "So what's the plan on food?" And I said, "Well, I was going to ask you the same thing, and I need to know that way I can prepare for it." And he said, "Is it possible to cook steaks on the river?" And I said, "Absolutely."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, I'll sponsor the steaks if you'll take care of everything else."
Oh, cool.
So he sponsored the steaks, but I had to cook them and do all that kind of stuff. So I did. I don't have a problem doing that.
So you were in two boats?
We're in two different boats.
Okay.
Yep.
So did you, you know, bring a gas grill or something with you, or were you cooking on a campfire?
On a campfire.
Nice.
What I do is I cook. Well, I brought some utensils, you know, silverware and stuff like that, plastic that we could burn in the campfire. But what happens is I build one campfire for warmth and light, and then another fire, a little bit different. It's not really a fire. I'll kind of explain that to you. But basically what I do is I'll build a small little fire and then take some logs and square it off to where it conceals it and holds that heat in, and it directs all the heat straight up,
right,
rather than just dispersing out.
Okay.
And then I'll set a grate of some sort of metal grate, like an old barbecue grill grate, over the logs, and then I can put a skillet on there and cook.
Perfect.
It's awesome. It's the way it's pretty neat the way it's set up.
So the steaks were good?
The steaks were phenomenal. So how often do you eat ribeyes on the gravel bar?
Oh man.
And then the morning after, which I'm getting a little bit ahead because I'll tell you some stories about how the trip went itself, but I'm just talking about the food right now. And then the morning after I made them omelets. So and you know, that's pretty they loved that. You know, ham and eggs obviously eggs and cheese.
Right.
Mushrooms and sausage. And
nice.
Just the whole nine yards. It was fun. It kind of reminded me of Bill a little bit because Bill's got
the
gravel bar gourmet. And that's what I took a little page out of his book there when I told them, boys, you're going to be eating at the gravel bar gourmet part two or something.
Yeah.
Talking
cool.
about Bill's. So, but yeah, they, Wade actually, it had been so long since he'd been at the river and fished there. He even commented, he hadn't held a fishing pole in at least 15 years.
Now he's the lawyer?
He's the lawyer.
Okay.
Yep. He's the lawyer. And you know what's so great about Wade is he is, even though he lives in a city, he's got a place on Table Rock. He loves the water. It's not like he's unfamiliar with water. He loves the water. He's got a place on Table Rock in Kim City, which is Kimberling City to us outsiders. But that's what they call it, Kim City.
Okay.
And he loves to surf. You ever think about
surf?
He surfs. He's got his boat set up. He rigs his boat to where it creates a wake. I mean a big wake to where he can literally, on a surfboard, surf behind it.
No kidding.
Yes, it is. It is so cool to do this. It's kind of neat because the design he had to put on his boat to create this wake, he's, you know, it was kind of his own idea. There's other people that have the same idea, so it's not like him that has it. But I'm going to help him produce one in the future that he's got this great idea for. So wow. It's kind of neat. So I'm excited about that as well. But yeah, he surfs on Table Rock, and that's his fun. That's what he enjoys to do. But what I was going to get to was, no matter all the, you know, he's a lawyer. He's done really well for himself. But he still comes and hangs out with us simple folk. You know what I mean? He's still coming, hanging out with us. He's still the same way that was when he was in high school.
Yeah.
He looks the same, sounds the same. He's just got the same personality. I just really respect the heck out of him for that. You know, it's just because we've got some other classmates that have done well for themselves too, but yet they don't really seem to come back around too much. You know, so I have a lot of respect for that man and all of them in that. So we're fishing on this trip. We take off, and it's me in the back, Rex in the middle, and then Wade sitting in the front at this point. We've got our camp and stuff, and then James are over in the other boat. And
so these John boats, canoes, or what?
John boats.
Okay.
Yep, they're John boats. My John boat just has a trolling motor on it because it's in the summertime. You get shallow shoals, and it's just easier to – the lighter weight you can have, the better off you are. You know, a lot of people, the old-timers prefer canoes or kayaks, and – I'm a little spoiled. I like my John boats. Yeah. I like to be able to stand up and cast around. So we're all in John boats, and we got poles. I set them all up with stuff I think that is going to work for fishing, and we start going into the first shoal or two. And of course, you got to remember they don't know what to do. They're unfamiliar with this river scene,
right?
And so I know, oh, we got to get turned around. I grab a paddle. And I hadn't put my shoes on yet because I got shoes I wear just to get in the river, get in the water, so I don't run regular shoes. I hadn't had them on yet. I didn't get them on yet. Well, they kind of panic, and they're grabbing a paddle, and the pole goes flying in the water, and another one, and they're like, oh, there it goes, and it's just chaos all at once. And it's my stuff.
Oh, yeah,
it's my
stuff.
It's not like they lost their own pole, so obviously I'm jumping in to get it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's only a couple foot deep. So I jump in, I grab the pole, I shake it out, I grab the boat, everything's safe, we're good to go. We're all laughing hysterically because it's like, you know, well – we started this trip off with a bang, you know, and you know, it's like we hadn't even been away for the last 15 or 20 years, because we do have class reunions, but that's about all we see each other, and we kind of vouched on that trip that we'd start, you know, we had such a great time that, you know, we've known each other our whole life, so it's like we need to start seeing each other more and hanging out doing stuff, friends. Just, you know, we don't live that far away. Springfield, Missouri, it's an hour away, you know, from me. So anyway, we got down to our first spot. I rigged Rex up with the white fluke. He throws in there, and a fish comes up and hits it. And he goes, oh, I missed him. He had it. And then as soon as he hit the water again from missing that one, there he come right back, and he got him this time.
Same fish, you think?
Same fish. I think it was. It was. But if it wasn't, it was still a nice one. He ended up landing his fish. It was like a 16-inch smallmouth. So it's a nice fish.
No kidding. Beautiful. That's a big smallmouth.
That is a big smallmouth, you know. Very good. And then so over the course of the trip, we caught numerous fish. I mean, it was just a great trip, and the food was great. The company was great. It was just a trip to remember. And of course, we camped out overnight, and then we got up the next morning, made the omelets, packed everything up, cleaned our camp area. One rule we always have, or I always have, when we go camping – and Justin, my good buddy Justin, that's kind of our rule when we go camping. You always leave a gravel bar in better shape than when you found it.
Right.
So that's what we try to do. You know, make sure there's nothing left there to show that you was there as far as that goes. So we did that, packed everything up, headed out. And I bet Wade said 10, 12 different times, man, what a day. Yeah. What a day. You know, and he just – and I said, boy, it is a nice day. And he goes, not just nice day, but – good friends, good fishing. He said, I just really miss. He goes, bringing me back to my roots. He goes, I just really never knew what we had here until now. Now I'm seeing what kind of a special place this is after being away and living in a city for the last 20 plus years. And there's not many houses on the river, but there's a few. And he made the comment. He said something about just seeing those houses up there and being down here and experiencing this, it just makes me wish I had one of those houses too. You know, and I wouldn't doubt it if he don't have one for too long because he's seen, you know, and he said, I took for granted a lot of the things that, you know, we all did. I did too. And not just him. I did too. It's just I was fortunate enough to stick around to where I still have this right in my backyard, you know, the rivers and the deer hunting and the turkey. And he was talking about he's a big waterfowl hunter. You know, he loves duck hunting. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm not saying I'm good at it, but I like doing it.
Right.
Said, so how does that work? He said, well, the guy says, I think he says, shoot or get him. And he pulls up and he starts shooting. That's all he knows. He starts shooting. And if one falls right in your boat, that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah, right.
So, he said that don't happen a whole lot, but he loves to do it. So we're going to have to do that too. Like I said, it was good to get out with my old friends. You know, we graduated 21 years ago, and it's good to get back with them and reminisce, I miss them guys. So it was a great time and probably my most memorable camping trip ever.
People are rich in different ways.
They sure are. They very truly are. Well, that's about the end of our time for this segment of segment three.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we will be right back after the break with Rick Fishback, the guy who set up a hunt with his young son who killed a monster buck on opening day. We'll be back with that story in just 3 minutes. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source for information about what's going on in the world of outdoor recreation in the Ozarks and points beyond. This segment of our show is brought to you by Shady Lane Cabins and Motel in Eminence, offering you a comfortable night's sleep after a long day on the river. We have Rick Fishback on the line with us now. Rick, welcome to Wild at Heart.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Well, I understand that you had something to do with a big old buck shot by a young archer.
Yeah. It's kind of my best friend's son. He's kind of my nephew, and he killed a giant opening day with his bow. He's only 13 years old.
13. I seen that. I knew he was 13 or 14. That video has kind of gone viral on Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. What a story, though. There's nothing better than seeing our youth being in the outdoors and the excitement. That video was priceless. Watching that video and the excitement in his voice. I bet I've watched it 5 or 6 different times.
Oh, just the pure rawness of it. It's amazing, man. It's great.
Oh, I thought the same thing. So tell us a little bit about the story of that buck. I know that he had saved up, and I'll just let you tell the story about what do you think? I mean, that's an amazing story and how that kid saved his money up to get his own bow, and I don't know if that was your property. Did you help in on the hunt, or was that just something that you knew about? Or I seen there's some pictures with you with him. So
yeah, you know, I mean, I've been taking him hunting since he's – me and his dad since he's 9 or 10 years old, and he's definitely always got cream of the crop stuff to hunt, and we love it. We always try to make sure that he's a little on the advanced side because we started him so young,
right?
But he's, you know, he appreciates it. He appreciates it to the point that, you know, he's not a sit around the house kid. He worked all summer long with a guy stacking brush that logs for a living, and Hayden at 13 years old spent his summer dragging brush and stacking brush for a logging company, and his main objective was to buy a new bow. And
wow.
He saved up his money and worked his tail off in the heat all summer long, you know. And you know, a lot of us older people, you know, I mean, we're used to that hard work and bucking hay and stuff, and there's not a lot of that that goes on anymore, and he kind of got a taste of it and worked right through it and did a good job about it, saved his money up, went and bought him a new bow, been watching a really nice deer out there behind, over there where he lives, mm-hmm. and been patterning him. We, you know, got trail cameras out there of him, seeing what time he comes through, and first night in the stand, I mean, just made it happen. And
yeah.
Then, you know, he shoots his bow so much, and he only had the bow a month, and has about wore the string off the thing. he practices so much, and I mean, he's 13 years old, and he's not an overly sized kid by any means. He's just an average 13-year-old size, and, right. and the kid pulls. He started off at 55 pounds, which is pretty strong, and
that is,
until the day he was hunting. He's pulling back 65. So I mean,
wow.
He worked all the way around. The kid is just—he just works hard at it. He's got a good work ethic.
That's impressive. That's very impressive for a 13. I know full-grown men that don't pull back 65 pounds.
I pull 70, and it's a lot for me to pull it.
Yeah, 70 pounds is quite a bit. That's impressive. So he had this buck patterned. He knew he was after this buck too. This is the buck he wanted.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He had that buck picked out, knew that was the buck that he was going to kill, and he wasn't going to shoot nothing but that buck. And as luck would have it, he didn't have a chance to shoot nothing else but that buck.
Yeah, worked out even better, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, how big was that buck? I know, or how far was it? Because watching the video, it looks like that thing was 80 yards out. But
he shot it for 40.
Yeah.
And hit it perfect. He shot it for 40 yards and smoked it. He practices all the way up to 50 all the time. We hunt a lot of fields, and a lot of your opportunities aren't up close and personal.
Right.
And, you know, that's not his first deer killed on video, neither.
Really?
There's another great video out there that may be better than that one of his first deer he's ever shot with a bow.
Wow, that would be. I'll have to check that one out. You have to send that to me one of these days. I like to see that one.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I think he shot it at 10, maybe 11.
Yeah, that's awesome.
At 10 or 11 years old, he shot that. He's an exceptional kid, and he has a lot of opportunities. And we try to always make sure that he's has those opportunities, and he's always rising to the occasion.
Is he a fish? Is he an angler too?
Oh.
I figured he would be.
If it has to do with the outdoors, whether it's fishing or hunting or stacking brush, he's all about it.
Well, you're definitely raising him right, you and his dad, that's for sure. Just the way you guys are putting him out there, giving the opportunity to do this stuff, you know, because a lot of these kids, it's not really their fault. You know, they don't have, you know, a role model to do that, to give them this opportunity to show them what's out there and to go hunting or fishing or hiking or whatever it is, you know, just being in the outdoors that, you know, our society has just kind of turned to electronics, you know, and being indoors instead of outdoors. And a lot of these people just don't know what they're missing. I just love seeing these youngsters get out there in the outdoors.
Yeah. And you know, he's just a talented kid. He's a kid that plays every sport in school and is at the top of the game. You know, he's the quarterback on his football team. He's the point guard on the basketball team. It's amazing that how active that he is at that age, being able to schedule fishing, hunting, and all the sports that he plays, whether it's school ball or club ball, and makes it all happen. And it'll turn him into an exceptional person as he gets older with that kind of a work ethic.
Oh, absolutely. I guarantee that. There's, you know, you was talking about the work he did just alone is impressive on a kid that age, you know, to sit there and work that hard to achieve something, to get what he, you know, to achieve his goal. He did it. And that's going to make for a great adult in the future that knows that he's got responsibilities and to work hard to achieve something. And everything's not just handed to you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. A lot of people are really proud of what he's doing, and I'm happy to be part of just even the little bit of hand that I have to help out with it. You know, I mean, it's exciting times, you know.
Yeah, it is. Very exciting. Well, there's some other things going on. I know, you're a huge, huge fisherman, and I was wanting to talk to you about, your fishing. You know, how's the fishing going right now for you? And I know you just won. You recently won a lot of big tournaments, but I know you won a tournament here last weekend. It was USA Bassin.
Yeah, at Lake of the Ozarks.
Yeah.
It was, man.
Yeah. How did that go? How was the fishing there at Lake of the Ozarks? And how'd you win it?
Yeah. You know, fishing's really good right now at Lake of the Ozarks. You can catch them shallow. You can catch them deep. They're staying really stable, which is a good thing because the weather's stable. You know, this weather goes to change. These fish will change. But right now, there's a lot of good deep fish to be caught because the water's still hovering in the upper 70s.
Right.
And those fish are patternable because if you can catch them in 15 foot of water on a secondary here, you can go and duplicate that in other areas of the lake. You know, first thing in the morning, there's a good topwater bite. It's fall right now on Lake of the Ozarks. The big boats are starting to get a little less
abundant,
active out there.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's a good thing. I love it when they start leaving.
For sure, for sure. And the fish are starting to get more active as the big boats are starting to leave. So it's a good time right now on Lake of the Ozarks, you know, and it's only going to get better. It really is.
So what is some of your favorite things to throw? Obviously, I know one thing, a crank wrap. Any kind of crank wrap you put on there is going to be good. Those things are killer. I mean, I'll tell you what, I can attest for them more than anyone. I know Chad gave me one at a tournament. He said, here, let me just wrap it for you. He wrapped it for me. And as soon as daylight hit, I caught like five or six fish in like seven casts. And one of them was a 5.5-pounder. And
Yeah,
them things are, that crappie pattern is amazing.
Okay, Tommy, you got to explain what this is. What's a crank wrap?
Well, how about I let Rick explain it? He can explain a crank wrap to a T. Tell us what a crank wrap is.
Okay, man, what it is crank wrap is an application. Me and a business partner, Chancey Walters, come up with this deal. You know, now, don't confuse it too much. It's kind of like a wrap that you put on your truck. It's a wrap that you put on your bait, but it's not the same kind of material, so to say. We've got a special application and a special ingredient that this material is made out of that goes on your bait and takes it from old to gold. You know, you can take any of these crank, I mean, any fisherman that's fished for any amount of time has a bunch of old crankbaits laying around the house. It's beat up,
crashed,
whatever, bargain bend at Bass Pro down to $1.99 because the color ain't right. Well, our wraps are actually templated for the size of a crankbait that you want to throw. So let's say you want to go throw a DD-22 because you have a bunch of them at the house that you don't throw no more. We make one that's already cut to size, like a dress for Barbie. I mean, it goes line up the eye, line up the tail, stick it on, and go to work. It takes about 30 seconds to put it on, and it's the real deal. It looks just like a shad or just like a crappie or just like a bluegill. They're a real-life image of a bait fish, of what the fish are feeding on. And you can change it. You can take it off and put another one on, put one on over the top of it. They will not take hook rash. They will not scratch, wear out. I mean, you'll lose the bait before you lose the wrap.
That is awesome. Yeah. Hold that thought. We're going to take a break here, and we'll be right back with this. Just hang on here. Don't go away. In our next segment, we'll talk to Rick about how he adjusts his fishing to the season and the lake. I'm Tommy Bench. This is Wild at Heart. Stick around.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. This segment of your show is brought to you by Advanced Performance Shooting in Waynesville, offering classes on firearms use and safety. We have Rick Fishbeck on the line with us. We're talking about crank wraps at the time. So getting back to those crank wraps, you know, that's one thing I can attest. Like I said, I've used those, and those things are absolutely phenomenal on how realistic they are and how much it changes your fishing, because you can match the hatch, you know, like Rick said, old to gold.
So, Rick, does this actually have like an image of a fish, you know, like screened onto it or something?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it has. You know, it has an image of a bait fish or of the forage that, you know, what you think the fish are going to be eating in your area, you know. And we cover from anywhere from the southern lakes all the way up into Canada, we cover that kind of bait fish.
And how do you make it removable? I mean, what holds it onto the bait?
Well, removable as in it will come off the bait. It has a time-released adhesive. So once the bait is on there, and it's been on there for, you know, a minute or so, you can't get it off. A fish couldn't get it off. You can get it off and put another one on.
Okay.
You can't, per se, reuse the one that you're taking off.
Okay.
But, you know, you can definitely remove it from the bait and put another one on if you did, you know, if you think that you needed to change colors on the fly.
Huh. Yeah, and that's very possible. You know, if you're seeing gizzard shad, you know, and you got a crappie pattern, but you're around a big school of gizzard shad, then that would be something you could swap over real quick, especially if you know the Bassern area.
Yeah, and, you know, we did this because, you know, Chansey especially, he's a wildlife artist, number one, but I was real big into painting my own baits, painting my own lures, and, you know, that takes a lot of time. You're taking hooks off, you're soda blasting them down, and to get them perfect for you, you can put another paint job on them, and, you know, or, you know, maybe, you know, a lot of guys, it takes, you send a bait off to get painted, it takes 2 to 3 weeks to get it back.
Yeah, and if you do, I know the ones that I've experienced, you're going to pay for them, too. You're going to pay premium dollar. I mean, I've got some wiggle warts. I've got some warts that I had custom painted, and I think I paid $15 to $20 a piece for them. So,
yep, and they're going to hook rash right up.
Done. Yeah, yep. But you know, there's something else about them crank wraps. I think it was either you or Chad. I think it was you that was taking something and just scratch it, trying to literally tear it up, and it wouldn't even scratch it. I was impressed by that too.
No. Yeah, they're tough as nails, man. They really are.
Well, hey, something else I'd like to talk about, not trying to jump subjects on you because I love the crank wraps. But you know, there's something that's really impressed me about you, Rick, is you're not just a Lake of the Ozarks angler. You know, you fish a lot of other lakes and do very, very well. I've heard your name, even though I know you, know who you are, and know your reputation. But I've heard other people talk about you on some other lakes. Was it Stockton is one of your lakes that you do well on?
Yeah, Stockton and Palmy are my home lakes.
Palmy.
You know? Palm de Terre Lake. I've cut my teeth on those two lakes there, and I've been fortunate. I'll say that. I've been very fortunate, and it just, you know, I'll put it back onto kind of the work ethic thing. You know, I put my time in. I work real hard at it. I'm a big structure fisherman. I put a lot of structure out. And, you know, I think it's just you get out of it what you put into it.
I agree.
I've been fortunate enough to have the time to do that and be put in a position to be able to do that.
So what would you compare lake to lake? I mean, how much different do they vary as far as the way you fish them? Do you have to make huge adjustments when you go from Palmy or Stockton or whichever one, or Truman? I guess Truman was one of them. But you know, I mean, what I'm saying is, how much adjusting do you got to do if you got to go to Lake of the Ozarks and fish a big tournament there?
You know, from Palmy to Lake of the Ozarks, there's a huge, huge difference. I've had my share of success on Truman and Kentucky Lake also, Bull Shoals. I travel to them, you know, all. Not like I used to when I was a young man, but, you know, there's a big difference between Stockton, Palmy, and Lake of the Ozarks. Stockton and Palmy fish the same, pretty much. But, you know, when you go to Lake of the Ozarks, they say there's more shoreline than there is on the California coast.
That's right.
On Lake of the Ozarks.
There is. Yeah.
You know, that's saying something. And there's a lot more water. There's a lot more adversity, you know, especially when you're, I'm sure your guy could Google it, but there's got to be 30,000 docks on that lake.
Oh, yeah, it's got to be. So how do you know which docks to target? Like, for example, if you was fishing Lake of the Ozarks this weekend, how would you approach it? What would you fish? Where would you go if you was trying to catch some good bass or a big bass, you know, in particular? So what would you do? I'm just curious on how you would approach.
Yeah, no problem. Well, first off, I'm a big graph guy, man. I think if you don't have good electronics, I think you're behind the eight ball a little bit. You know, you're going to be a little behind. And the first thing I would do is I'd start graphing the mouths of those creeks, especially the big creek arms, and I'd start looking for shad before I started even looking for fish or anything else. If the shad ain't present, the bass more than likely aren't going to be active or present themselves.
Absolutely.
We're at the time of the year where we have what's called a shad migration, and you'll see it in the evenings or first thing in the morning. You'll see them shad migrating across the top of the water, even out in the middle of the lake. Hmm. And they're all headed to the backs of them creeks, and those bass will be following them. So, you know, you kind of follow the food, and that's where the bass will be.
Oh yeah, that's, you know, I had Jack Ux on the show here a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I know Jack real well.
Yeah, he was talking about that. He mentioned something about the shad population isn't what it typically is. You know, he said he was kind of shocked that there wasn't just abundance of shad, and that he thinks that this year in particular, if you can find those big balls of those big groups of shad, they're going to be key because they're not as abundant as they was in years past where the shad were just everywhere.
He's right to an extent on that too. I think, you know, we've all been talking that we think the shad hatch is really late this year, so they're not as big as what they normally are this time of year, so they're not as noticeable. You know, a shad doesn't get out and roam until he's a certain size to where he's noticeable, you know?
Yeah, they'll
stay up in the shallows and tucked in and everything until they get to a certain size where they got to have more food and they start moving more, which makes them migrate. So our shad hatch is really late this year, and it's caused those shad to not come up and be as seen as early in the year as we normally are used to seeing them.
That makes sense, because like I said, this has been 3 weeks ago, two or three weeks ago when I talked to him. So,
yeah,
you know,
exactly right. And that's about when we had our shad hatch.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So. So, what kind of baits? I mean, what would be your number one bait you're going to grab if you're going to Lake of the Ozarks this weekend? If you know, what would be the first thing that you're going to think of to catch a big bass?
You know, if I was going for a big bass, if I'm going for a $100,000 fish, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to be throwing one of two things. I'm going to be throwing a big swim bait, or I'm going to be throwing a big crank bait. I'm real particular on what I like to throw. I'm a big believer in a Jinko booty shaker swim bait. It's a 6-inch swim bait. It has a lot of vibration. And I'm a big believer in a Spro Little John DD white crappie crankbait. And that's really throwing it out there on the table. I mean, that's the key to what I really do. And it's done for me personally very well. It's a big fish target, though. You don't get a lot of bites on that stuff.
Yeah, but that's that's exactly right. But you know what? You know, a lot of us guys that fish a lot, you know, like you and myself, you know, we've been there. We've been out there catching them numbers, and we've gotten to the point that I'm sure you're the same way. I'm just to the point now to where I'd rather catch quality over quantity. I'd rather catch big fish rather than a bunch of small keepers. You know, we've all been there. So I'm after – you know, most tournaments, 5 big bites. I don't, you know, and if it's a big fish tournament, like the one, you know, like the Big Bass Bash, I'm just going for one big bite. And I don't care if I only get one or two bites all day or all weekend, as long as it's the right one.
Yep, and you're absolutely right. Not a lot of people understand that, you know. There's nothing wrong with the new format that's coming out with MLF, but we as, you know, smaller tournament fishermen, we're not MFL style. It's the 5 best we can catch,
right?
Not the most that we can catch.
Exactly. I was talking to Watson about that.
He's all pumped up about it. I'm happy for him too.
Yeah, he is. That's his style, though. That's more of what he likes to do, I guess. And I'm happy for him. And
yeah,
it's a good deal. But yeah, so that, yeah, I just wanted to pick your brain a little bit and see, you know, the kind of baits, and you said two of them right there. What do you think about a topwater? You think it's going to be a topwater bite at all this weekend, or no?
Man, I think if it'll rain, like they're calling it to rain, if it'll get cloudy and nasty, I would not be surprised to see that $100,000 fish caught on the topwater. I really would not be surprised to see that. But if it doesn't rain and get cloudy, I don't think that'll happen. The fish have been stable with these sunny days for so long. Unless it's right first thing in the morning, I wouldn't see a big girl being up just real shallow yet.
Yeah, you still think they're going to be a little bit deeper?
I believe so. I think the best odds are anything's possible. But if you're going to run the numbers, for sure your best chances are going to be somewhere offshore on a deep spot.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking too. Or like you said, them creeks. Follow them shad around them bait fish, and you can't
absolutely.
Really go.
Absolutely. Yep, and there's plenty off, you know, off deep stuff in those creeks.
Yeah, no, for sure there is. I don't know if how congested all them creeks are going to be or how not congested they are, but it's going to be good. It's going to be that's the main thing is getting out there and fishing. You know, that's all you can do is get out there and go fishing. And hey, Rick, well, I'm running out of time here, but man, I appreciate you being on the show, and I'd love to have you back real soon. And I'll be seeing you soon, I'm afraid, probably this weekend. I'm sure of it. So,
all right, man. Well, have a good night, you boys. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks again, Rick, and appreciate you being on. When we come back, we'll be talking about trapping with Justin Elliott. I'm Tommy Bench with Wild at Heart, and we'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment of our show is brought to you by Colton Steakhouse and Grill in Rolla, where we know what's at stake. Also by Trout & Sons, serving you with boats, motors, trailers, and accessories since 1972. Located on County Road 1000 in St. James, it's always fun at Trout & Sons. On the line with us now is Justin Elliott, a trapper from Richland, Missouri. Good to have you on the show, Justin.
Well, thanks for having me, Tommy. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I told John just a while ago, I was more excited about this segment than about any of them because it's what I know the least of, and I've been wanting to pick your brain for a while on your trapping skills, and I know you're very good at it. So how's the trapping going?
Last year was a little rough. I took a lot of instruction last year. I'm really fortunate, Tommy. I've got some of the best mentors in the United States, some of the old guys. So I did a lot of traveling last year. I went to Iowa. I trapped up there with the Drury brothers, with the Drury Outdoors. Then I came back home, went to northern Missouri. Then I ended up in March. I ended up in Texas trapping with some guys from out west. So last year was really good. I had a lot of fun. I learned more last year than I ever did. So I'm really looking forward to this year. This year, I'm going to stay home all year. I'm not going to travel. I'm going to stay with my family and really tear up the Ozarks. I'm excited about it.
Good deal. I'm excited for you. I'm excited that maybe I can, since I don't live too far away, we're kind of locals together. I can say, hey, John, take me with you. I want to learn. Or Justin, yeah. Sorry, I was looking at John.
No, you're right.
There was a Trappers, what was that, the Trappers Association?
Missouri Trappers Association Fall Rendezvous.
Was you at that, yeah. Justin?
Yeah, yes, sir. I'm the District 6 director.
I figured you were.
Yeah, I'm the District 6 director, and I'm the the fur auction chairman for the state of Missouri. So we have an annual fur auction every year. So, yeah, I was at the rendezvous and the meetings, and it was a great time. We had a good attendance, and a good time was had by everybody. It was nice.
Well, good. I figured you were there. My co-host Jerry Cook was there, alive, and we were talking about it. I didn't actually get to attend it. I wish I would have now, but he mentioned something about he was really impressed on the turnout and the young people that were there. And I mentioned to him, I said, I bet my buddy Justin Elliott was there, and he said, well,
oh, you know it.
I figured you was. Yeah. I knew you were. So tell me a little bit about trapping, because I don't know a whole lot. I know that you're good at it, and you've had some good mentors, and there's a lot. You know, trapping is kind of a lost art with people. There's not a whole lot of trappers left out there. You know, to you there might be, because that's what you're into, and you're associated with those people.
Right.
But
so
what do you – just what do you think? I mean, as far as like trapping, give me a broaden, like what is something very, very or sought after? You know, what is everyone after? You know, it's kind of like in the bass world, everyone's after that 10 pounder or right. Whatever it is. I mean, is there something in particular that when you trap, you're really looking for something special, or it's, you know, when you trap a certain species? And tell me something about a little bit about that.
Okay. So in Missouri, our trapping season opens on November 15th.
Okay.
So, and it's right there during deer season, Tommy. So a lot of times I can't get access to ground because a lot of people are deer hunting.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Right. So what I do is I'll trap water. So I'll trap raccoons the first half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
I can get on the water. I'll trap otter, beaver, and raccoons. In Missouri, the most sought after fur, you would say, I know it is, it's bobcats. Everybody wants to catch a bobcat.
Hmm.
And when it comes down to fur value right now, our fur value is very low. It's an all-time low. It's a shame. But our interest in the public for trapping has really came up. I don't know if it's just, and there's a lot of guys that they just want to, there's a lot of young people that just want to do it during Christmas break, after deer season.
Yep.
So I would say bobcats are the number one animal. That's like your trophy animal. Everybody wants to catch a bobcat. Now, I normally don't start trapping bobcats until Christmas time until the end of January because our season lasts until January 31st.
January 31st. Okay, well, that's good information because I didn't know that. Not being a trapper, I love to get into it and learn more about it, but I didn't
Absolutely.
Know that. So,
Justin, how many bobcats have you caught?
Oh, since I've been trapping?
Yeah.
I don't know. I would say...
Ballpark figure.
200.
200?
That's amazing.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive. Yeah. That's very impressive.
And that's just in Missouri. I've caught some cats in Tennessee. I've traveled to Tennessee before in February and bobcat trap down there. On a good season, through January, that's when I really try to trap bobcats. On a good stretch through there, you want to catch one or two a day. Sometimes I catch three a day. But, you know, I'm trying to look for that 20 to 30 cat year number. And if you look at our fur bearer biologist report, if you look at her report, Laura's report, we have an extreme amount of cats. I mean, the bobcat population is thriving. So people, I've had people say, well, you're going to kill all the cats. No, you're not. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, but yeah, that's, I mean.
But if you didn't have trappers like yourself, then they would. It would become an issue. It would become a problem, you know, with too many cats. You know,
that's what happens with coyotes and raccoons.
Yeah.
There's disease sets in. If we don't go in and maintain and harvest that renewable resource, they'll suffer. They'll get distemper, they'll get mange, and that is not good.
Because, not good at all.
I mean, it's a terrible way for that animal to suffer. We'll go in as trappers, go in, humanely harvest that fur, sell that fur. Nothing goes to waste. You know, the farmer's happy. The deer and turkey hunters are happy.
Absolutely.
Happy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's good all around because they're predators. They're after the farmer's chickens or cattle or whatever it is. So getting rid of those coyotes or the bobcats or any of those predators, I mean, it's essentially what they are, that helps.
Absolutely.
All around. It helps, makes it, like you said, makes everyone happy. Nothing's wasted, and everyone should be happy in the end. And it's good, man. That's a good deal. You know, I was thinking about this. Have you ever heard, and maybe you have, I don't know, but I know they're here. I've seen it with my own eyes. We had one that was just hit on the interstate a few years back. But have you ever heard of anyone that trapped a mountain lion?
Now, there was a gentleman that did catch a mountain lion, I want to say maybe 8 years ago, down in southeast Missouri.
Okay.
And he did catch a mountain lion in a big, really big homemade cage trap. But I'm in the woods a lot. I'm always looking at the ground. Now, granted, we don't have snow that stays on for very long.
Right. Yeah, we don't.
And I have never seen any sign of a mountain lion that I could definitely say
that's a
big cat. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's a big cat. I'll have to get with you and get you over to some of the places. One of the places I hunt where I seen one multiple times. Oh, it scared the heck. I won't lie. It kind of scared me. And I
bet.
Oh, when I first seen it, you know, I'm thinking, oh, it's a deer because it was kind of behind the woods, you know, in the thicker timber. And it was moving really slow. And then I noticed that I thought to myself, it's just kind of odd for that deer to be moving that slow. And I was trying to figure out if it was a doe, if it was a buck, and I just wasn't even sure for sure a deer, but it had that tan color. Then when I seen its tail, I won't lie. I'm bow hunting. It's not like I have a gun. It's going to be hard to draw back a bow and shoot a cat that big walking out of dark. And so I was very nervous. I was very nervous and a little concerned. I made it out okay, and then, of course, I called conservation and told them about it. And they said, sure. Thanks for letting us know. And I told my brother about it and some close friends. And some people kind of laughed, you know, oh, yeah, whatever. You didn't see it. Justin, it wasn't 6 months later that it was all over the news. And if I don't know if you know where I hunt, but I hunt right there. Where I seen it was right there by the interstate, by the Oasis, where my parents live. That cat was found, if you remember right by the river, at Hazel Green. Yep. You're talking less than 2 miles away, a big cat.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm friends with all the biologists with the NBC. They're a great, great group of people.
Mm-hmm.
There's been, I don't know exactly, Tommy, how many, what the number is on the confirmed sightings and confirmed cats in Missouri. But, you know, we do have cats in Missouri.
Oh, yeah.
If we have a population, a breeding population, that I don't think has ever been established.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't think so
with records or anything like that, but they're definitely here. You know, we just have to learn to live coincide with them. But they are dangerous. You know, out west, you hear.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a lot of buddies out there that elk hunt, and they're nothing to play with. They'll hurt you.
So what do you do? I mean, that's what I was going to get to. I guess if someone does trap one of those, is it legal to trap, or is that something you gotta? I mean,
no. There, it's same way with black bears. There's no season for a black bear or a mountain lion in the state of Missouri.
Okay.
So now trapping and shooting is two different things, because if I trap one, I wasn't intentionally trapping one.
Exactly.
I have one caught. I pick up the phone. I call my local conservation agent and say, hey, you better get over here, because we're going to have to deal with it.
You know? You're going to have to let him go somehow, and I'm not going to do it.
Right. I'm pretty sure what they would do, Tommy, is they'd come in with a couple guys, and they would, you know, with tranquilizer guns, and they would do research, draw blood, and they would turn them loose and probably collar them, put a tracking device on them.
Oh, sure. Yeah, just like anything, like you said, with a black bear or mountain lions. Makes perfect sense.
Right.
Well, there's a few other questions. I got to take a break here, Justin, but we'll be right back here in a little bit, and I'd like to talk to you more about some trapping, and more so on how you particularly target certain species, you know, like whether it be a fox.
No problem.
We'll talk about that. Coming up in our next segment, we'll find out more about trapping with Justin Elliott. I'm Tommy Benson. This is Wild at Heart. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information, the Ozarks and a few points beyond. This segment is brought to you by Guard Truck and Equipment and the Outdoor Superstore, your Husqvarna dealer located on the North Outer Road in St. James, and the Missouri Trappers Association, dedicated to preserving the heritage and skills of trapping. And speaking of trapping, we have a trapper on the line with us right now, Justin Elliott. Thanks for holding on, Justin.
Oh, no problem, Tommy.
So, what do you think on your opinion? We was talking about trapping and the different ways to trap. I know there's different... You know, there's got to be a technique to doing it other than just putting a trap out. I mean, you don't just blindly set a trap somewhere.
Absolutely.
So how do you do that? How would you, you know, target a specific, you know, go ahead. Just talk about one, whichever one you feel like starting off with. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, I'm sure a lot of people, definitely starting out, we just did a group. We had a youth clinic. We trained 20 kids how to start trapping. So, with somebody starting out, the easiest thing for you to do to have success with in the beginning is catching a raccoon. You need to go, when you think of a raccoon, you want to think of water, because they don't live in the water, but they hunt and they feed in the water.
Okay.
So any of your farm ponds with good trees around it, any of your creeks or your rivers, you're going to find raccoon tracks. And just like deer and turkey hunting, when you find signs, that's where you want to target. So
absolutely.
With raccoon, what you want to do there is, you know, you want to imitate something that's natural. You know, dig a hole back in the bank, like where you see where the crawdads have been digging in the mud.
Right.
Or where something's been, you know, like just any kind of hole that the fish are going to go up in, the crawdads are going to go up in. You know, then you place your trap in front of that hole underwater, put you a piece, you know, the best thing to do for raccoon is put you a piece of fish, sardines or something back up in that hole. But now they've come out with a dog-proof coon trap, and you can set them things anywhere and not affect, and they're called dog-proof because you're not going to catch anything but a raccoon or a skunk or a possum.
And why is that? Because of the size?
Yeah, the way it's designed, Tommy, it's a tube-shaped trap. In the raccoon, you put the bait, which would be in the, with this thing, you could use fish or any of it. Marshmallows work great.
Marshmallows?
Put a marshmallow, Tommy, in the bottom of that DP trap.
Okay.
And when that raccoon goes, he hunts with his hands. He's going to reach in that trap. He's going to grab that marshmallow, and when he pulls it out, the trap goes off, and it pins his hand in the trap. It just restrains him. It doesn't.
Gotcha.
You know, it's just a restraint. So that's right. A good way. And with them, you know, you want to use them in your barns where you have house cats and stuff like that, or just barn cats. You don't have to worry about that. But that'd be a great way. You know, then a lot of people, they want to catch, you know, like we were just talking about, they want to catch a bobcat.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we are very fortunate. We have a great bobcat population in the Ozarks. One of the best in the United States. We're up there in the top, I think, 15 or 10. Everybody, we all have cedar trees.
Yeah. We got plenty of those.
If you ain't got cedar trees, you ain't in the Ozarks. So that I really focus around that the cedar patches, Tommy, I do. And anywhere that them cedar patches run down and touch water, I look for a funnel point, just kind of like you would with a deer. You want to look for your funnel points because they're going to hunt in them cedar patches. So you get in there and you're going to find it's hard to find tracks where we live. It really is.
Yeah,
If you take your time, there's going to be a trail that's going to have a little bit of mud in it at one point or another, and you're going to find that track because it seems like, this is crazy, but it seems like every cedar patch I've ever been in, there's bobcat sign in that cedar patch. So that's where I like to focus for bobcats. But when we talk about, you know, then we'll go into another predator with the coyote. You want to be in I'm looking for more open farm ground.
Okay. Well, that's funny you mentioned about the cedars, because I hunt around some cedars and I see bobcat often. But another thing I'll mention is being a good trapper. You definitely need to be good at familiarizing yourself, or good at identifying tracks, because so many people misconstrue these tracks. They say, oh, that's a big bobcat, or it's a fox, or whatever it is. If you truly know what tracks are there, you're going to become a lot better trapper, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, because you're going to use a different technique to target that bobcat than you will for that coyote or that fox.
Okay. So what about foxes? Are they highly, highly sought after as well, or no?
They are, not as much, as because our population right where we live is not really that high. It used to be, but it's not that high anymore. In parts of the country where there is a lot of fox, people like to trap fox, definitely new trappers, because they're a very pretty animal.
They are.
They're very soft fur. There are certain areas in the Ozarks where I trap that there's a good population, and you can go in there and harvest them fox. With red fox, it's the same as the coyote. They're really in the open. They hunt the fields. With a gray fox, really closely with a bobcat and a raccoon, they stay in the brush. They stay in the thicker wooded areas, the cedar patches, the growed up CRP fields, in areas like that. That makes sense. You know, coyotes and red fox, more open country. Bobcat, gray fox, more dense, more brushy cover area.
Well, that's very good information, because I never knew that. I'd have thought a fox is a fox, whether it be a gray or a red. I figured they was the same habits, but they're definitely not. Is there One more question, Justin. I'm gonna let you talk. Continue on about your traveling. I'm like a sponge right now, absorbing all this because I want to learn so much about it. But is there any common misconceptions with trapping?
Common misconceptions. Yeah, I get this a lot, and I got it the other day when we was teaching these kids. Everybody thinks a trap hurts, and it 9 times out of 10, when somebody's uneducated about trapping, they'll say, "Well, that trap will cut. You know, it'll cut the foot off or it'll break bones."
Yeah.
Traps are not built that way. We're not in the business to hurt an animal.
Right.
Where he will get away. Now, we're going to harvest that animal, but we're going to do it humanely. And so I'll do it right in front of everybody. I'll just set a trap and stick my hand in it and say, well, I didn't break a bone. So, no, they're made like handcuffs. They really are, Tommy.
Yeah.
90% of them now they're offset. They have a gap.
Uh-huh.
They don't break bones. They don't make, a big bloody area. They definitely do not amputate any part of the animal.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. That is definitely a misconception that most uneducated non-trappers believe, that a trap is going to be violent and painful, and like you said, it's not. I mean, it's just a it's basically to restrain the animal.
It's exactly right. It's a restraining the animal, be it. Now, this happens, you'll be on somebody's farm and their dog's running loose. You'll catch, you have a good chance of catching that dog. And I always carry an animal catch pole with me. I put the catch pole on the dog, the domestic dog, release it.
Yeah.
The farmer has no clue. Tommy, the farmer has no clue I caught their dog.
Yeah, they never even know because he wouldn't even hurt. It's not limping or anything.
No. Now, they are scared.
Yeah.
I'm being very blunt about that. When you catch a domestic animal, they're scared and they're frightened because they don't understand what's going on.
Right.
Once you release him, if your truck door's open and you release the dog, guess what? You've got somebody riding in your truck with you for the rest of the day. Cause that's exactly where they go.
Yeah. Especially you're their new best friend because you let them free.
Yeah. Right. So, a lot of people don't talk about catching domestic animals. I do because I want to educate people. It does happen. No one does it on purpose. But there's ways to release that animal, let your landowner know, hey, I caught your dog. Everything's fine. Checked out good. So,
yeah.
I don't sugarcoat it. A lot of people don't talk about it. But I'm here about, I want to inform the public. I don't want to keep away. I don't want to. Keep that door shut. I'd like to open that up and be free information about it.
Well, I think you just taught a lot of people a valuable lesson about trapping, or the misconceptions about trapping, including myself. I didn't understand, and I never really, it's not like I was one of them that said, oh, you're hurting the animals. It wasn't like that. I just didn't realize that they were so animal friendly as far as they didn't break bones or, I'm sure that there's going to be some kind of chafing on there because they're going to try to pull, but that's just because they're trying to get loose or whatnot. But all in all, they're just restraining the animal, and you're going to harvest them, safely. So,
yep, absolutely.
Well, that's very interesting. So, coyotes, what are the main animals trapped that you would trap in particular? I know, of course, bobcat, foxes, coyotes, raccoons.
Yeah, bob, raccoons early. Otter and beaver.
Okay.
When the river's right, how that gets.
Oh yeah.
Can't run a jet boat. I'll stay off the water. Now if they call me and I'm on their farm and the river's right there and they want the beaver caught, I'll go in and harvest the beaver. Same way with the otter. No one in Missouri that I know of likes an otter. So
no.
If people's got otter in their pond. If people have otter in their pond, my phone is blowing up.
You can have all the otter we have. You
yeah. Have they, and yeah, that's in same way with beaver. I don't know anybody that wants a beaver or an otter.
Yeah.
And which is fine, which is fine because I enjoy harvesting them and processing the fur and teaching my kids. So I'm more than happy to come take care of your otter and beaver problem for sure.
I'll definitely get a hold of you too.
Yeah.
But hey, Justin, we're already about out of time again. I've got to have you back on the show for too long,
man.
So we can talk some more. And thank you so much for the awesome information, and it was great having you on, and I'll look forward to having you back again. I'll get a hold of you soon, Justin. Thanks again for being on the show.
Tommy, I sure appreciate it. You guys have a great night.
You too. Thanks. Coming up in our last segment, we're going to talk about transitioning fishing patterns from fall to winter and how you catch fish during this time. I'm Tommy Bench, and this is Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back. I'm Tommy Bench, and you're listening to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Salty Jack's Bar and Grill in Eminence and by State Farm insurance agent Michelle Beckett in Sullivan, helping life go right.
So, Tommy, we were talking about transition fishing. Well, actually, you were talking about transition fishing, and I'm thinking, transition fishing. What is he talking about? And then I realized you were talking about the transition between the seasons.
That's it.
So so how much difference is there in fishing in the summer or fishing in the winter or this, you know, magic fall season?
Well, let's just go through some of the transitions that the fish go through, in particular the river or any kind of fish. They all relate to the patterns of the seasons just like we do, but more so them. They don't have a calendar, so they only go off the water temperature. And that tells them a lot of everything. That's why so many anglers are always like, what's the water temperature? What's the water temp?
So do you carry a thermometer with you?
I do.
Okay.
I carry a digital thermometer. It's basically, believe it or not, it's one I got from O'Reilly's. It's supposed to measure like parts.
Engine temperature
or something? Temperature, the head, stuff like
okay.
that. But it's precise. It'll
okay.
be down to the tenth of a degree. So I like to know exactly what the water temperature is. And that tells me a lot about what the fish are doing or not doing and
so
why they're doing it.
How far down in the water are you measuring the temperature, right? The surface?
The surface temperature. So
okay.
that will change below, and that's another thing we're going to talk about, and the reason why these fish do what they do. Okay, so in the spring, we'll start with the spring. The water is warming. It's a warming trend from the winter. You know, from the winter, usually around in March
mm-hmm.
and April, the water is slowly warming up, and that's when those fish know it's time to spawn. That's their spawning period where they're starting to move out of their wintering holes and go to their spawning grounds. And they're going to go to the spawning grounds, and the males will make the beds, and the females will lay the eggs, and the males will protect the beds. They're both on the beds at one point in time. That's where a lot of fishermen will bed fish, what they call sight fishing, because the beds are in shallow water. And the reason why they're in shallow water is so the sun will penetrate through the water column and warm the eggs and fertilize
right.
and all that kind of good stuff. So that's one season right there. You got spawning bass or perch or bluegill or whatever it is, any kind of just a fish in general. They'll spawn in the spring.
They start spawning at what temperature then, roughly?
It depends. Fish vary anywhere from upper 50s to lower 60s.
Oh, so pretty warm.
It's pretty warm.
Okay.
The old wives' tale or whatever terminology that is, when the dogwoods are blooming, the bass are spawning. So
okay.
when you see them blooming, that just pretty much goes hand in hand with the bass to spawn
okay.
at the same time. But too often I get people that will ask me, well, what's the fish doing? What do you think about the end of October or late June? You really can't predict that. You really got to go on and just go on history and say, well, I know – generally, the water's about this temperature, and they're really active. It's a good month to fish and whatnot. But all in all, that water temperature, just like we were talking to Terry Robertson earlier, you know, conservation agent, he's talking about how unseasonably warm it is this year, and it changes everything. It's the same thing with the fish. They're gonna start moving at, you know, out of their fall pattern later because of that warming trend. So getting back to the spring, you got them spawning, and now they're moving on to their summer pattern from the spawn after they spawn. Now they're wanting to feed heavily because just like the bucks in the rut, they've got to recoup from all that vigorous work they just done. So now the females will start to really feed up to fatten back up and replenish their energy from that spawn. Then, so they usually get to where they're very active. Summertime, the fish are active. The warmer the water, the more active the fish are. I've always said it just holds true. It's just like anything else. But when that water's warm, they're active. When it's really cold, they're real lethargic and not too active. So now you got summertime, highly active, moving around, spread out all throughout the water. They're spread out here, there, everywhere. They're at this piece of structure. They're at this hole. They're in that shoal. They're everywhere. It's just warm and comfortable pretty much everywhere. It just depends on their mood. I just want to go. It'd be like just like they think that certain fish eat certain things. Well, fish, smallmouth, they'll eat crawdads. Well, sometimes they don't want crawdads. Sometimes they may want a bait fish, or sometimes they may want a bluegill. Sometimes they might want a helgramite or whatever it is. It's just like us. We don't need a ham sandwich every single day of our lives.
Right.
We have different tastes. But so now you have their summer patterns where they're pretty much spread out all throughout the body of water. In this case, we'll say it's a river. And then in the fall, everything starts to cool off. So now it's a reverse effect of what we were talking about, the spring to summer. Now it's almost going backwards, but instead there's no spawn involved. So now these fish have done this more than once. They just know. It's just like God just give them this intuition that, hey, this is what's going to happen. So when it starts to cool off, they know we've got to feed and feed heavily, because when it gets really cold, we're not going to feel like feeding because it's going to be too cold for us. So these fish will literally set up in certain places in the fall. It's so great. That's why I love the fall fishing so much. And you can catch them about every way, top water and bait fish imitations in particular. I don't know. Go ahead.
So are they looking for the deep holes for the warmth of the water, or are they looking for the food there, or both, or what?
Both.
Okay.
See, the bait fish do the same thing. So, okay, just like we were talking earlier to Rick Fishbeck, he was talking about chase them shad around. The bass will follow the bait around, just like all the other fish, walleye or any. It doesn't matter. All the fish that eat smaller fish, that's just a cycle of life, they're going to follow those bait fish around. So the bait fish are going to these deeper holes. And, in the fall, they're moving. They know where they're going to winter. And when they winter, they're not like they was in the summer where that you could have found them and every 50 yards you're going to find a fish or less. There's fish on that root wad. There's fish behind that rock. There's fish underneath that shoal. They're everywhere. Just a little bit, just some places are more abundant than others. But all in all, they're spread out through the whole river.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall, they're starting to move. You can catch them in certain areas. You can catch them shallow early in the mornings, feeding heavily on the bottom of the shoals. Then they'll move deeper. And then once it gets so cold, once the water starts to get so cold over the winter, they will, like I said, they'll travel a long way and go to the same winter holes every year. And I only know that because of certain fish that I've caught in the same spot. I don't know where it come from. It could have been there all year around the area. But just from reading conservation, they'll tag fish just to see how far these fish will truly go to winter. And I've read articles from the conservation where they said they've literally tracked them at well over 60 miles.
Oh, my gosh,
just
really?
To go to the same winter hole.
Wow.
And then when they're done wintering, they go right back to their home, what we'll call their home.
Wow.
That's their home body of water.
Yeah, do lake fish do the same thing?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. See, the lake fish, they relate to, they winter different. The lake fish winter different. I know the fish on Lake of the Ozarks winter different. And they relate to more of the rock. And see, here's another thing that we'll get to. In the wintertime, the fish want to be as comfortable as they possibly can. So they're going to go to the environment that makes them as comfortable as they possibly can. In particular, a really deep hole. Because what we have in a really deep hole in a river, considering the river is not very deep,
right.
It's usually in that 4 to 7 foot range. The majority of the time, then you'll have a bluff, and it may be 15, 16 foot deep. That's a deep hole.
Right.
Well, there's a thermocline. You're familiar with a thermocline?
Explain it.
A thermocline is where the sun stops penetrating through the water. You shine a light through any kind of water, and eventually it's not going to hit the bottom if you're trying to see down 20 foot deep.
Right.
Same way with the sun. It'll penetrate so far, and if you've ever experienced it, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you ever jumped into some water and it's been warm and you're going down, and all of a sudden it just turns cold.
It's cold, right.
That's the thermocline. You just hit where there's literally a line of where the sun stops penetrating, so you got this certain temperature of water, and then it's colder below. The reverse effects in the wintertime. It stays warmer down there because of that bedrock, and that water stays away from that cold air from the top.
Okay.
So it takes it a lot longer to get cold underneath. So those fish will go to that underneath that thermocline and live underneath there over the winter and stay warmer.
Huh.
Even if it's only a few degrees, but it's still enough. But these fish will literally congregate in these winter holes, in particular like springs. If you think about it, a spring is constant water, 52, 53 degrees.
Right.
And when you're talking about ice on the top, like you were talking about earlier, it may be 34, 35. Well, now you're talking a 20-degree difference. These fish, and anyone that has not experienced wintertime bass fishing, especially on rivers, they're missing out. Because I'm telling you, that is my favorite time of the year to go fishing. The fish are all in one spot. Yeah, it's cold. Bundle up, be warm, and it's great. It's great fishing. But man, we blew through that.
We're out of time again.
But, yeah, the wintertime fishing, transitioning, the transitions of different times of season, it's good to know that because if you understand what fish do from season to season, you'll be better at catching them.
Okay.
So, Wild at Heart is heard live every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 with a repeat Sunday morning from 8 to 10. The show is produced in the studios of ESPN 107.3 in Rolla and engineered by John Francis. We'd like to thank all our guests today, Terry Robertson, Rick Fishback, and Justin Elliott for joining us. Don't forget, you can always listen to a podcast of the show. Just go to our website at ESPN1073.com, click Programming and Wild at Heart. I'm Tommy Bench. Thanks for joining us.
Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3, powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm Agent Michelle Beckett. The latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, 4 p.m. Wednesdays and 8 a.m. on Sundays on ESPN 107.3.